Call the meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Policy for January 4th, 2023 to order. A quorum is present, so we'll get started. I first just wanted to thank everybody for making that drive in today. Got to hit the ground running, and I guess we're going through snow too. So, and wanted to just kind of, I know one of the most common questions I got during the interim, or you know, after the committee chairs were assigned, was sustainable infrastructure. What is that? And you know, I really just want, what my vision is for this committee is to kind of look past the two-year budget cycle and really figure out how we take advantage of a lot of this federal infrastructure funding. So, you know, we have our communities over here and we have the funding over here, but a lot of our communities are going to have a hard time accessing that funding just because it's something they're not used to. And so we want to make sure that we're able to put policies in place that really help our local communities and make sure that they have a place to go where they can find out best practices, where they can figure out best ways to apply for federal funding, and really help with the planning of our infrastructure as well to make sure that we're using good materials, that we're having projects that have co-benefits, and that we're really just getting the best bang for our buck when it comes to our physical infrastructure. And so I first wanted to then, members and staff, before we start official business, too, we want to remind members of our two in-person committee practices. We haven't done this in a while. So many of you guys haven't ever been in a committee hearing room, so it's kind of exciting. But through a roll call, roll calls will not be done for attendance, but members are expected to attend all meetings. When unable to attend a committee hearing, members will be marked as excused if they notify the CLA or CA in advance of the meeting. Otherwise, members will be marked as absent in the minutes. And today, I think everybody has a reason for being late or not here. So, and all procedural motions, approval of minutes, adopting amendments, and votes that refer a bill to the general register or another committee will be done by voice vote. But as always, any member of the committee can request a roll call. And so thank you all for being patient as we get used to being back to in-person committees. And so that, with that, I'd like to go ahead and have our members introduce themselves. If you could just say your name, the areas that you represent, and I don't know, maybe why you wanted to be on structural or on sustainable infrastructure, or if it's just one you got kind of tossed into. So we'll start with Representative Anderson.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Hi. Representative Paul Anderson, beginning my eighth term. And redistricting really changed my district. I know I go from the South Dakota border to fairly close to St. Cloud. Rural ag district. I'm a farmer, by the way. And this committee intrigued me in terms of, this, Madam Chair, what it was going to do. And I don't know if the focus is going to be on transportation or exactly what, but it interested me to see what we could look ahead and do and prepare for whatever is down the road.
Representative Franson?
Hi, Representative
Lead Franson.
I am your Republican lead on the committee, representing District 12B, so I have the entire city of Alexandria, Melrose, Sauk Center, Greenwald, Osakis, Carlos, Nelson. I hope I'm not forgetting
a lot of great ladies.
So anyway, regarding this committee, yeah, I'm just curious to see. I have the chair and I met a few weeks ago and went over it, and I think she's going to do a really great job. Personally, I'm really curious to see how, when the federal government is $31 trillion in debt and we're paying super high inflation rates right now, how the Inflation Reduction Act is actually going to help that when we get the actual funds to pay for it and spend some money. So we shall see, but thank you.
I'm Representative Gilman, Don Gilman, brand new freshman. Happy to be here. I represent District 17A. It's redistrict, brand new district, and McLeod County, Meeker County, and a little sliver of Wright County and Sibley County. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm just curious, the title, Sustainable Infrastructure, I'm just, like, curious how things are sustainable with infrastructure. So.
Hardy. I am from Inver Grove, or my district is 53A, Inver Grove, Mendota Heights, Sunfish Lake, Lily Dale, and West St. Paul. This committee I signed up for, yay, I was really happy to get out of here. Just really interested in the equity piece and how that's going to be integrated.
Hi, my name is Representative Breanne Curran. I represent Badness Heights, White Bear Lake, White Bear Township, Gem Lake, and Birchwood Village. And I was interested in sustainable infrastructure because I know it brings so many important pieces together that I think it really does deserve its own space, so I'm glad to see it does. And I know it's really important work to my district as well. I know that through the district I represent, they're looking at a lot of long-term solutions for some of the older things that are breaking down, and I think this is a good way to be part of that. So thank you.
Representative Aaron Cagle, represent District 39A, which is still getting used to saying Fridley, Hilltop, Columbia Heights, and Spring Lake Park. So my district changed a lot. I only kept two precincts, so I'm getting to know a whole new part of my area. And so, but one of the reasons that I was really kind of pushing on the for this committee is the deep dive into the IIJA that I did last session, and really just seeing all the, they're putting carrots out there for us. And so we have a really huge historic opportunity to figure out, you know, how do we get those carrots, but then also make sure that we are doing really thoughtful, collaborative planning when it comes to our infrastructure and moving us towards the future. I know I joked with a lot of people before this, but I see us at this kind of Y in the road right now, and to the left is the Walking Dead and to the right is the Jetsons. And so I want to get us to the Jetsons over there. So thank you guys so much. We'll go to Representative Hornstein, then we'll do staff.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is Frank Hornstein. I represent District 61A, which includes downtown Minneapolis and a couple of the neighborhoods just to the east and north of downtown. Also, a good part of uptown Minneapolis, if you're familiar with that area. And I'm currently chair of the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee, and I think there's a lot of intersections between this work that we're going to do in this committee and the work we do in transportation. I'm very interested in looking at infrastructure through a lens of safety, climate, equity. And, you know, we live in a country that I think has tremendous resources, and I look around at other countries around the world that have made substantial investments in their infrastructure, and I hope that we can do the same. And so much of our infrastructure is literally crumbling, and the investments we make in this are so critical to a healthy and good society. So I'm really happy that we have carved out in the House time and space to really dive into these issues.
Representative Eagle.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Representative Patty Acom. I represent the new District 45B, which is Minnetonka, Wayzata, Woodland, Deep Haven, and Shorewood, like many. It's a little different than my old district, so it takes a little while to get used to the new names. Just was elected to my third term, so I'm excited to be back at the Capitol. This was one of my top committees to request. I'm so glad to be able to be on it. I think of sustainable infrastructure, and I know that we as a state and all communities within our state need to be doing better at building resilient and adaptive infrastructure. And so in my previous world, I served as a city council member. And so the opportunity, as Chair Keagle said, for the carrots that are being offered by the federal government and for all levels of government to be working together to really improve and make our infrastructure better. And if we work together, we can certainly get further. So glad to be able to be here. Thanks.
Representative Rahm?
Reem.
Lucy and mine's Reem. Cagle. Sorry, I know. I should have just stuck with Anderson, right? Then we'd have three of them. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. So I'm Lucy Reem, newly sworn in representative for 48B, which is all of Chanhassen and a good portion of Chaska, the eastern part. I served on the city council in Chanhassen, so I know how important infrastructure is. I'm really excited to work with transportation on these issues that address the sustainability and the environmentalism that we need to be looking at. And let's see, I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Yeah, I'm Representative Andy Smith from Rochester. 25B is my district, which is just right downtown. If you've gone to Mayo for anything, you've been to my district. And I would like to blame my tardiness on the snow today, but I got lost in the Capitol. I admit it. I'm a first-termer. And I'm really excited about this committee. I'm a millennial legislator. I'm 31 years old, so whenever I think of infrastructure and sustainability, I think of our impending climate crisis and preparing Minnesota to really deal with that well. And spending money now will save money in the future, as well as hopefully lives and how hard that transition is going to be. So I'm really passionate about that, and I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. And Representative Kraft.
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm Larry Kraft, newly sworn in representative from 46A, which is just St. Louis Park. So as opposed to many of you that have lots of things to remember, I don't. I was very interested in this committee coming off serving on City Council in St. Louis Park. I see the real importance of infrastructure, and especially with the increasing impacts we're seeing from the stranger and stranger weather and flooding and things that we're seeing. And especially, I think the IIJA and the Inflation Reduction Act are so critical to leverage for our state, especially from a climate lens. I mean, the IRA is the federal... is a tremendous act, but is the federal opportunity that we have and the one that we will have for addressing climate change. So I'm real interested in how we do that.
All right. And Representative Eichel?
Sorry for being a little late, too. Snow got me as well. I'm Representative Spencer Eichel. I'm going into my second term, so I represent the new House District 7A. So that's Greater Itasca County, City of Hibbing, and then Northern Aiken County. So... when I think of sustainable infrastructure, I guess I think of my district because of the resources that they offer to sustainable infrastructure. So whether that be the critical minerals that we need to build infrastructure in the future or our logging industry, right? We can't build homes without the sustainable forests that we have in the state. So I was really excited to be on this committee because I think my district in northern Minnesota can offer a lot to the conversations in this committee and hopefully find a lot of solutions.
Great. And then, of course, the people who make us all look smart, our staff here. So we'll start with Mr. Marble.
Joe Marble, I'm covering this committee, and I also, as well, for GOP research, do the transportation, finance, and policy.
Thank you. And I know Jennifer Nelson texted me this morning and was stuck in her driveway, but she'll be our DFL researcher. And then we'll go over to Mr. Burris.
Good morning. I'm Matt Burris with House Research, which is one of the nonpartisan offices in the House.
I'm Dan Dodge. I'm staffing this committee as well as capital investment.
And our CA?
I'm Anna Borgreening. It's my third session at the House. I'm so excited, but my first is a CA, so I'm also on the Judiciary Committee, so I'll see many of you there too, I think.
And then we have our pages as well. Zach, and I didn't get to introduce myself this morning. If you want to say your name?
Nash.
So those will be our committee pages as well this year, so... Welcome, everybody. Thank you all for making the trek in. And, right now the only agenda item we have today is a presentation by Kristen Hildreth and Aaron Ray of the National Conference of State Legislators. They will be giving an overview of the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. When we say IIJA, that's what we're referring to, and the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, which I just think is kind of it's weird to say, particularly as they pertain to Minnesota. And so Ms. Hildreth and Mr. Ray, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. I'm Kristen Hildreth. I'm NCSL's Senior Legislative Director for Natural Resources and Infrastructure, and I'm joined here by...
Good morning. My name is Aaron Ray. I'm the Associate Director for Energy at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Happy to be with you and looking forward to answering any questions the committee might have. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, we're excited to get started. Can everyone see the presentation on the screen, sans note view?
Yep.
Perfect. So thank you again for having us join you to kick off your 2023 legislative session. As many of you are aware, the National Conference of State Legislatures is the nation's largest bipartisan organization representing the legislatures of our nation's states, territories, and commonwealths. We're really excited to be here before you all today to share an overview and kind of an update on where the federal government is at currently with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, what that funding looks like for Minnesota, and then a quick review of the Inflation Reduction Act and any potential next steps the state may choose to take. So there's a lot of information in the forthcoming slides. We're not going to hit on all of it today, but if you have any questions after the fact, please don't hesitate to ask us following the presentation or follow up with us later. Our email addresses are going to be available at the close of the presentation. As you're all aware, we've seen a number of infrastructure-related policy items over the last 2 years, including the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which I'll also refer to as the bipartisan infrastructure law, but I'll try to pick one or the other and stick to it. Which was signed into law in November 2021. And it's kind of been in place for about a year and a half, a year and 3 months now. And the Inflation Reduction Act, which was signed into law late summer of 2022. There's a few differences across the two, which I'll highlight later, but some information to hold on right now is the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act is going to provide your state and communities with funding across a period of around 5 to 10 years. It's program dependent for some of them. And the Inflation Reduction Act is supposed to support longer-term policy initiatives and contains some funding which is complementary to the provisions within the IIJA. So the IIJA, which we'll delve into first, authorizes around $1.2 trillion for transportation infrastructure spending, with around $550 billion of that going towards new investments and new programs. Funding from IIJA is expansive. It addresses energy and power infrastructure, access to broadband internet, water infrastructure, transportation, and more. But for the purposes of this committee, we'll be honing in on three main policy areas: transportation, energy, and a couple of our climate resilience provisions. As I mentioned, most of that IIJA funding is going to come through existing programs. So there's a chart up here that shows how the funding is flowing, either from existing or new. It's a key factor to note is the existing programs mean that the federal government is getting that funding out to states sooner rather than later, given the lack of need to develop some of those new programs. That said, with those new programs, a lot of them are still in the upstart kind of process. According to the federal funds information for states, allocation estimates for Minnesota total around $7.4 billion, of which most of that funding, roughly $6.1 billion, has to be matched by non-federal resources. It's my understanding that your state budget director came in last year and gave a summary to the House Capital Investment Committee, I think just over a year ago today, maybe last February, breaking down some of that funding. Minnesota is anticipated to receive over 5 years by state agency. You can see on the slide kind of that pie chart breakdown. Good segue for our start of the presentation, but Minnesota's Department of Transportation is going to be responsible for roughly 75% of the anticipated funds to Minnesota from the IIJA. With that, let's delve into our transportation provisions to start. But before we get too into the nitty-gritty, I think it's really important for all of us to set a baseline and provide a bit of background on existing federal funding for surface transportation. Some of this may be a repeater for some of you. For some of you, it might be new information, but I just think it's important to kind of lay that groundwork. So the federal government generally attempts to pass multi-year transportation authorizations that typically cover the gamut of transportation modes. So surface, water, aviation, with surface, which includes roads, transit, and rail, being significantly larger than those other pots of funding. These authorizations are then provided appropriations on an annual basis. For example, for surface transportation, Congress last passed a five-year authorization in 2015, which some of you may know as the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act or the FAST Act. And in 2020, Congress did extend that for another year when they were unable to reach agreement on reauthorization. So where does that all kind of fit into IIJA? Well, the IIJA included surface transportation authorization. So if I could sum up some of those transportation provisions within the bill, I'd say they're incredibly strong for states. They provide a significant amount of funding through formulas to states rather than competitive grants or grants to local governments, with my one caveat for that being that there are a number of new competitive programs of which states are eligible for and they will need to apply for. Minnesota in particular, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act represents around a 30% increase of overall state highway formula funding. And the Department of Transportation, as I showed on a previous slide, should expect to see around $5.45 billion of the state's $7.3 billion total. The federal aid highway program is made up primarily of a few core programs, which provide funds to states through formulas, as I highlighted above, which each program having a slightly different goal, although there is some overlap, and states can transfer a small amount of funds to other states as needed. So that's kind of a quick review of those programs. The federal government just announced the apportionment of FY 2022 funds in December of 2021, just a month after the IIJA was signed into law. And in October of this year, they did announce the apportionment of this FY 2023 funds. So it's one area in which we're seeing states, or funds roll out to states really quickly. I believe you all have this slide deck. Each of those links, or each of the underlined areas are links. They're hyperlinks that you can click on, and it'll direct you to the program itself. In addition to that nearly $300 billion that we saw available via the federal aid highway program funds, we're seeing around $26 billion come nationally in funding for new programs, including the PROTECT program, or the Promoting Resilient Operations for Transformative, Efficient, and Cost-Saving Transportation program. It's a new formula program. It's anticipated to provide around $121 million to Minnesota for infrastructure resilience improvement projects to address vulnerability for the effects of extreme weather and natural disasters. Highway, transit, and port projects are certain eligible uses for these funds. In addition to the formula funds I just mentioned, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act does authorize an additional $1.4 billion for competitive program grants to be awarded to states and local governments for eligible highway, transit, passenger rail, and port projects, very similar to the formula funds. And then another new program, the Carbon Reduction Program, under which Minnesota is anticipated to receive around $106 million for projects which reduce transportation emissions. Of that total, 65% is going to be for grants to counties and other local governments on a per capita basis, with some eligible projects including traffic management, public transportation, bicycle and pedestrian facilities, congestion management technologies, and alternative fuel deployment projects, which includes charging infrastructure, among several others. As part of that program, the state is going to need to develop a carbon reduction strategy within 2 years and update it every 4 years. Bridges are on here as well. Minnesota is anticipated to receive an estimated $320 million in formula funding for the bridge program to conduct bridge replacement, rehabilitation, preservation, protection, and construction. 15% of the total bridge funding is designated for bridges outside of the federal aid highway system, and that's funded at 100% federal funding share. In addition to the formula funding for bridges, it also authorizes a $12.5 billion competitive grant program for the Bridge Investment Program. IIJA also included a substantial amount of funding for both electric vehicle infrastructure as well as for the transition from traditional gasoline or diesel-powered vehicles to those which are electric or low-emitting. The National Electric Vehicle Charging Program was funded at $5 billion nationally for its discretionary grant, and its discretionary grant and charging fuel program was funded at $2.5 billion. So it's providing a total of $7.5 billion in this area to procure and install electric chargers, with a goal of building a national network of electric chargers and to support charging in communities where people live, work, shop, etc. That formula program targets electric vehicles along charging corridors in interstates, while the grant program instead invests in charging and fueling infrastructure. That fueling could include hydrogen, propane, and natural gas along both corridors and communities. The U.S. Department of Transportation and the U.S. Department of Energy issued a joint guidance document for this program, laying out, you know, where those public chargers can be built, the state cost share, it's 20%, and the potential role of the private sector in this. As of September of this year, DOT approved electric vehicle infrastructure deployment plans, which are necessary for states to receive the funding of the new program, for all 50 states, DC, and Puerto Rico ahead of schedule. With that approval, states now have access to all FY 2022 and FY 2023 funding under the National EV Infrastructure Program, and Minnesota is anticipated to receive $68.2 million under that program to support charging infrastructure development. Really quickly, I'll also mention the Clean School Bus Program, the Low to No Emission Transit Bus Program, and the Electric or Low Emitting Ferry Grant Program, supporting buses and ferries to zero emission alternatives. While they're not formula funds per se, states are eligible to receive them via competitive grant process. For public transit, the primary point I want to leave you all with is the scale of the investment that we saw with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. 40 of the 90 billion that was allocated is new funding and investment. So it's the largest ever for public transit. But it's also important for you all to know that much of that federal funding for transit does operate on a federal to local structure versus a federal to state structure. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act authorized funding from the Highway Trust Fund's mass transit account for existing transit formula apportionment programs. So that includes urbanized area formula grants, rural transit and intercity buses, bus and bus facilities, and a senior and individual with disabilities program. Minnesota itself is anticipated to receive around $800 million in total transit funding over the next 5 years, with an increase of approximately 30% from the last year of the FAST Act funding that we saw in 2020. In addition, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act also contained a significant amount of funding for competitive transit grant programs, so capital investment grants for fixed guideway investments, including corridor-based bus transit, bus and bus facilities grants, which is available in addition to the state formula funding for this purpose. And then there are other areas of multimodal transportation that include funding. So the construction of ferry boats and ferry terminal facilities, of which Minnesota is supposed to receive just over $16 million, roughly $300 million for airport infrastructure grants and $23 million for airport terminals, all of which are awarded by the FAA directly to local airport operating structures, $32 million for railway highway crossings, and more. This funding, this slide total shows the funding total for Minnesota's highway and motor carrier funding under IIJA. It'll be across the next two slides to give you an idea of what the state should receive over the next 5 years to bolster its infrastructure. And I say should receive, it should receive or is eligible to receive. The programs in bold are new programs which have not been previously funded. So those would be getting started by the federal government. It'll be new processes for your states to undergo. And then the graphic to the right shows a new couple of new projects which have already been awarded funding by Minnesota's Department of Transportation. More of that funding can be seen here, as well as several links to help you navigate the transportation funding as well. A couple resources, not only from the U.S. Department of Transportation, but also from Minnesota's Department of Transportation as well. So submitted and awarded projects, discretionary grants, then a grant tracking form, which the state has open. To get a better idea of when that those notice of fundings are posted and when applications are due, when funding has been or will be awarded, one can look to Minnesota's Department of Transportation's Grants at a Glance calendar, which provides a fairly good idea of where the funding is currently for the state. Federally, there has been a significant amount of funding announced to date for Minnesota, with overall, with loan guarantees, et cetera, around $2 billion announced in Minnesota for roads, bridges, roadway safety, major projects, $130 million in dedicated formula funding for bridges in 2022 and 2023, just under $100 million through the RAISE program, and just under $50 million through the INFRA program in FY 2022. Moving on to our energy programs, the IJ authorized billions of dollars in funding opportunities across a wide range of areas, energy included. Those funding opportunities include grid modernization, new electric transmission, energy system and reliability upgrades, electric vehicle charging infrastructure, improvement to energy efficiency of buildings, smart manufacturing, carbon capture and carbon utilization projects, renewable energy technologies and demonstration projects, and several other innovative initiatives. Minnesota's Department of Commerce is going to be responsible for most of these energy climate-related funding opportunities. In addition to those formula funds that I mentioned, there's also a significant amount of research and development for supply chain funding, with most of that funding provided via competitive grants for which states must apply. So that includes funding related to batteries, both for the provision of the materials as well as the manufacturing and recycling of those batteries and those containing critical minerals, research into carbon capture and storage, and support for nuclear. To quickly highlight, the IJ also includes billions of dollars to set up a new program, the Preventing Outages and Enhancing the Resilience of the Electric Grid Formula Program. I just have it couched under grid resiliency because it's a very long title. Of that, $2.3 billion awarded for that program available nationally, Minnesota is eligible to receive just over $30 million over that five-year period for projects aimed at improving the resilience of the electric grid against disruptive events. Grid resilience activities could include utility pole upkeep and removal of trees and other vegetation affecting grid performance, undergrounding of electrical equipment, relocating or reconducting power lines, improvements to make the grid more resilient to extreme weather events, and more. We also see around $3.5 billion available nationally for the Weatherization Assistance Program, of which Minnesota is anticipated to receive around $76 million for the 5 years. To kind of put that in perspective, between 2010 and 2021, Minnesota received just under $100 million. So you're receiving close to that, or three quarters of that, I should say, within 5 years. That program helps low-income residents with technical and financial assistance to help them reduce their energy bills by making their homes more efficient. The bill also provides a one-time $500 million allotment for DOE's existing state energy program, which provides funding and technical assistance to states to enhance their energy security, advance state-led energy initiatives, and maximize the benefits of decreasing energy waste. It emphasizes the state's role as a decision maker and administrator for the program activities within the state, really allowing the state to tailor the program to fit what is best for them in terms of their unique resources, delivery capacity, and energy goals. The funds themselves are used to provide technical assistance to states, but also to provide states with funding via annual formula grants and competitive awards. Those funds are then used for a variety of uses based on the state. So you can use them for energy resiliency, state energy facility retrofits, state energy plan development, energy emergency planning, and more. FFIS is anticipating nearly $8 million to Minnesota from the IIJ bucket, roughly two-thirds of the total amount which Minnesota has received since 2010. A few past project uses for Minnesota include your 2025 Energy Action Plan, which was centered on consensus-driven near-term strategies to add value to Minnesota's energy landscape. And it was a coordinated effort between your Department of Commerce, the Legislative Energy Commission, and several others. Energy funding to Minnesota can be seen on the slide here. To note, there are nearly 60 new energy-related programs, many of which are competitive grants, which states are able to compete for. One funding area that isn't listed here, but I do want to mention, because states are eligible for it, is the Program Upgrading Our Electric Grid and Ensuring Reliability and Resiliency Program. That's funded at $5 billion over FY 2022 to FY 2026. It's a new competitive program which will provide federal financial assistance to states and local governments to demonstrate innovative approaches to transmission, storage, and distribution infrastructure to help harden resilience and reliability. Some other funding to note, I'm going to run through really quickly here, the state revolving funds for clean water and drinking water. And I do want to highlight this as there are a number of allowable uses for these funds that fall in the climate resilience space and may be used for projects ranging from green infrastructure to water transmission and distribution. Of this, Minnesota is anticipated to receive over $700 million across the buckets on this screen. It's one area which states have a really significant role in the funding process, with states developing their unintended use plans and setting their project priorities, soliciting the projects, making decisions based off of state priorities, et cetera. On the climate resilience topic, there are a number of other competitive grant programs for which the state might be eligible for. And I just want to quickly highlight the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities Program, which provides funding to states and local governments to strengthen the resilience of their critical infrastructure. So that ranges from transportation, energy, water supply, and communications, supporting all of the above as they undertake hazard mitigation projects, really reducing the risks that you all face from disasters and natural hazards. Some eligible activities for those grants include natural hazard risk reduction activities, projects that may mitigate risk to one or more community lifelines, projects to enhance nature-based solutions, projects to enhance climate resilience, and then those which would also encourage the adoption and enforcement of latest building codes. But those BRIC expenditures are fairly broad. So coming to the close-ish of our presentation, we talked about where the federal government stands right now in terms of IIJA. What that looks like for your states, what kind of funding you can anticipate. But there's also another huge piece of legislation with funds to consider, and that's the Inflation Reduction Act. Billed as the single largest investment in climate action in U.S. history, the IRA includes tax credits, incentives, and a number of other provisions to address the changing climate and to bolster U.S. energy security. Several provisions within it bolster workforce development and permitting processes. And while not a topic for this committee, the IRA also includes several health provisions, revenue increases, cost savings, and more. There's around $67.4 billion in grant funding, according to the federal department that administers all the IRA programs, with around $40 billion of that for 18 new grant programs. As mentioned, it includes funding for climate protection, household tax credit and rebates for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects, and investments in clean energy production and other projects to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It extends renewable and clean energy tax credits while expanding others, creates consumer rebates for electric vehicles, and has a number of new home energy upgrade rebates, which flow from the U.S. Department of Energy to states to provide to their residents. And those are the High Efficiency Electric Home Rebate Program and the Home Energy Performance-Based Whole House Rebate Program. There are a number of other provisions that exist within IRA, including the expansion of the Department of Energy's loan authority, creating new loan opportunities for energy infrastructure investment, which would avoid, reduce, or sequester greenhouse gas emissions and support innovative clean energy projects, including carbon capture and more. There's also a number of transmission and siting changes as well within the Inflation Reduction Act, including the lifting of a 2020 moratorium on offshore wind leasing and also provision requiring offshore oil and gas lease sales on federal land should there be offshore wind energy lease sales conducted. There are also a number of environmental and climate provisions really broadly under the IRA. But one I do want to highlight for those in the room today is the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. It's a $27 billion program, of which states directly are eligible for $7 billion in competitive grants, which would finance clean energy and climate projects to reduce GHG emissions in low-income and other disadvantaged communities. There's several other programs listed as well, but the GHG Reduction Fund is one of the newest ones. It's one of the largest ones. It's one of the ones that EPA is consulting with states on right now. With that, I want to hand things over to my colleague, Erin Ray, to discuss next steps for states.
Thank you, Kristen, and thanks to the committee for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Erin Ray, and I lead NCSL's energy program. Now that you know a little more about the new resources available to Minnesota, I want to highlight a few next steps the committee might consider. First, as you've just heard, there are many new programs, each with its own specific requirements and deadlines. It's important for you and your state agencies to be reviewing federal guidance for these new and existing programs. Our understanding is that Minnesota state agencies are currently in the process of drafting plans to submit to the federal government in each of the categories of funding that Kristen has discussed. While this will be a multi-year process, strategic and effective state plans are a critical step in securing federal funding. For example, in the energy sector, which is my focus, at least 20 states have legislative mandates requiring comprehensive state energy planning. In Minnesota's case, you might consider the priorities outlined in your energy action plan and whether that plan is sufficient to guide new investments. Many of these plans were developed well before states understood the sort of significant new investments that the federal government would make available. And so you may need to think about whether your energy plan is appropriate to manage those new funds. You should also consider developing legislative priorities for state agencies to carry out. Consider your role in agency hearings and associated oversight. For example, the funds allocated to Minnesota could go towards whichever investments the state deems most necessary: electric transportation infrastructure, electric transit, weatherization assistance, energy efficiency, investments in the electricity grid, et cetera. It's important for the legislature that you take the opportunity to ensure that state plans reflect legislative priorities. You might also consider legislative approval for funds or executive branch actions and determining whether to provide matching or additional tax credits to leverage the federal tax credits that are available specifically through the IRA. In order to secure some of the funding that Minnesotans are entitled to, the legislature may need to either appropriate federal funds or appropriate state matching funds. Depending on the state, rules about appropriation of those funds are different. As Kristen discussed, a significant amount of funding for the IIJA comes in the form of either formula-funded grants, which might require a specific matching component, either from the state or from the private sector, or competitive grants that are more likely to go to projects that are able to leverage additional funding sources. Finally, you might reach out to congressional delegation to better understand congressional intent and how opportunities to take advantage of these targeted funds might be available to Minnesota, and NCSL can help connect you with federal agency officials if that would be useful. Now I want to move to the next slide and talk a bit about engagement and coordination, which is a key step that legislatures need to be considering. And we've highlighted a few sort of keys to success on this slide. First, consider coordination within the state's executive branch, which is going to be key. Many states are making use of an infrastructure coordinator or a similar role to coordinate activities across the executive branch agencies. And the White House asked for each state to identify an infrastructure coordinator to facilitate communication between the White House and states. But think about what the appropriate role for that person might be within your state. Second, you can use your role and the levers available to you as the legislature to encourage and support interagency collaboration. You could use your oversight role to press the executive branch to demonstrate that they are collaborating, to provide substantive and timely updates to you. You might also consider whether your executive branch agencies are appropriately resourced to implement these new or expanded programs or funding. In some cases, new resources might need to be made available. New capacity might need to be available to state agencies to be able to take advantage of some of these resources. On the other hand, there may be places where existing state funding is now duplicative with some of this new federal funding, and there are opportunities for the state to reallocate resources to serve your priorities. So be thinking about how state resources are enabling the best use of these federal funds. Third, I want to highlight opportunities for interstate information sharing and collaboration. A number of federal agencies are providing support and opportunities for states to learn from each other and to coordinate around specific programs. For example, the Department of Energy, which I work closely with, is providing technical assistance to states through NCSL, as well as through the National Governors Association, the National Association of State Energy Officials, and the National Association of State Regulatory Utility Commissioners, what we call the N groups. That technical assistance will be rolling out over the course of the next couple of years, and NCSL will share with you as legislators the opportunity to engage with DOE officials and with your colleagues in other states to share information and identify opportunities for collaboration. So much of that technical assistance is sort of still being developed, but I want you to be aware that there'll be lots of opportunities for you as legislators to engage with other states, to share best practices, to learn from each other, and identify opportunities for collaboration. And we'll be sharing more information with you about that in the coming months. Finally, I just want to highlight a few of the resources available to support the committee's work. The White House and nearly every federal agency that's involved in either of these bills is producing materials that explain new programs and funding streams. You'll find links to many of those resources here on this slide. I'll also note that NCSL has produced a number of resources that we've highlighted here and that are available on our website that are specifically tailored to the needs of state legislators. If you have other questions that aren't covered in these resources or you need help navigating any of these resources, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. Finally, I want to thank you for the opportunity to support the important work of this committee. As I mentioned, please don't hesitate to reach out to Kristen or me or any other NCSL staff if you have questions or would like additional support. We're now happy to take any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Wonderful. We have, I'm going to take chair's privilege right off the bat here and just ask, do you know how Minnesota is compared to other states in getting awarded funding from the federal government through these programs?
I think it's a little hard to calculate right off the bat. It's just all the programs coming out, all the federal programs that are providing funding to the states are really at varying levels. I will say, looking at Minnesota from the water side, you have all of your intended use plans in already, which is more than can be said for, I want to say, 30 other states at this point in time. So you've made progress on that. For the transportation funding, you're tracking the grants that are coming out of competitive grants versus formula grants. If I just would say anecdotally, I would say Minnesota is on the right path. But it's the appropriation of those matching funds for some of those programs which require a state match is one area that I think Minnesota could take action on.
Thank you. Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is somewhat similar to the chair's question, and it's that you talked a lot. This is clearly very complicated, and there's a lot of different programs. And so thank you for the presentation to help make it a little more clear. But as I look at all of these different opportunities for Minnesota and the fact that so many of them are competitive, so many of the grants are competitive in nature, how can Minnesota position itself best to get the most opportunities through these federal programs?
Aaron, do you want to take this one?
Sure. Thanks, Kristen. Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Acom. As you noted, I think one of the keys here is that we think about these bills as the IIJA or the IRA, and we sort of think about sort of the overarching vision and the resources available. But really, the work is going to happen in, you know, more than 100 specific programs, each with their own deadlines, requirements, opportunities. And so it is difficult to say in general sort of how any state is doing across the board. And in order to make yourself as a state most competitive for any of those programs, you really have to dig into what are the specifics of the program. That being said, I want to highlight a couple of opportunities where I think states are trying to answer the question that you asked and make themselves most competitive. So as Kristen just mentioned, one of the questions is what actions might the state legislature need to take regarding funding, whether that is appropriating the federal funding itself. Some states and in some programs, states have to appropriate federal funds. In other cases, federal funds that are flowing through an existing program can be obligated by that agency without further action by the legislature. So in each of these programs, one of the questions is the legislature acting to enable that funding to be spent as expeditiously as possible? The other question then is, as Chris mentioned, the matching funds and making sure that matching funds are available if necessary. In energy programs that I'm focused on, some of those matching funds may come from your utility. And so engagement with your regulatory commission is important to understand how utilities are or are not being asked to make matching funds available. And then the other thing that I would think about is how your state programs align with some of these new federal programs. So I want to give you a couple of examples. One is the Clean School Bus Program that Kristen mentioned. That provides federal funds for the replacement of diesel-powered school buses with electric school buses. Districts are the recipients of those funds. through the EPA Clean School Bus Program. But some states are taking state action to either support districts in making their applications, right? Many low-income rural school districts may not have the capacity to be able to navigate the application process. And so one thing a state might consider is, are you providing capacity to either public entities or even private entities so that they have the resources and the capacity to apply for some of these competitive programs or even formula programs? So that's one thing to think about. Another thing to think about, and then I'll stop, is how your state policy aligns with some of these federal policies. So for example, in November, DOE announced the first year of funding on what's called the Civil Nuclear Credit Program, which is funding intended to keep existing nuclear power electric generating stations open that may not be economical. The first program or project that was selected was the Diablo Canyon Power Plant in California. What's interesting is what the state did was pass legislation, Senate Bill 846 this fall, that extended the operation of that plant, but required the operator to pursue the federal funding and made a loan of state funds that the operator was obligated to return if the operator received the state funds. And so that state action enabled the operator to pursue the funding, but also protected the state in the case that the funding was received, which ultimately we expect it to be received in the state to have the resources returned. So that's one thing to think about is, are there opportunities where state action can enable either a public agency or a private entity to take advantage of some of these programs? So those are just a couple examples, and I'll stop there and see if you have further questions.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to echo my colleague's appreciation for this excellent presentation. My question is for Mr. Ray. You had mentioned a Michigan Infrastructure Council, and so I was kind of intrigued by that. You know, what is that? Who sits on it? What is its mission, if you have that information?
Mr. Ray?
Thank you for the question, Rep. Hornstein. I'm actually going to pitch it back to my colleague, Kristen, and see if she has more information about that council.
Thank you for that. So the Michigan Infrastructure Council itself is composed of, I think it's 9 voting members that represent a variety of areas. So asset management experts from the public and private sectors, financial and procurement experts mm-hmm. from the public and private sectors, and then experts in regional asset management and planning across the infrastructure sector. So it's really broad. It covers transportation, environment, energy, water, any form of infrastructure that you think of, this Michigan Infrastructure Council will cover. All the voting positions, so 5 of them are appointed by the governor, while the state's Senate Majority Leader appoints a member, the state's Minority Leader appoints a member, the Speaker of the House appoints a leader, and then the House Minority Leader will also appoint a leader. So there are voting members appointed by various levels of government, kind of bringing in these unique experts to analyze Michigan's infrastructure needs and ensuring that their executive branch and legislative officials are working together to best suit the needs of the state. And that's just one example of what a state is doing.
Representative Hornstein?
Just one quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So was this set up prior to these the IIJA, and are they allotted a particular, are they directing money specifically or just making policy recommendations?
I can't tell you exactly the year which the Michigan Infrastructure Council was created, but I can get back to you on its start date and whether or not it was pre or post IIJA. And they're primarily making recommendations.
And I actually have dug in a little bit on that Michigan Infrastructure Council, and it was established in 2015. So this was pre-IIJA. And I actually have tried to get in touch with the member who authored that bill, who was a Republican member of the Michigan legislature, but they have term limits, so I can't find his contact information anymore. So any follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, one of which was partially answered. had a question on funding for what the bill labeled existing nuclear when over the past 10 years or so, a lot of our nuclear plants have been shut down. And any funding in this large bill for the new generation nuclear plants, so the smaller plants, the cookie cutter type plants that seem to be having a small module plants that seem to be having a niche fit in some of our areas. So what's the situation in terms of research funding for these smaller new nuclear plants?
Ms. Hildren? I'm sorry.
I'm happy to cover that, Erin, unless you find that to be a better fit for you.
Mr. Ray?
Well, I'll say a couple of things, Madam Chair and Rep. Anderson, and Kristen can share additional information. Thanks for the question, Rep. Anderson. Across both bills, the IIJA and the IRA, there is support both for existing operating nuclear power plants and for what are termed advanced reactors, which often includes what are called small module reactors, and those sound like the projects that you're referring to. There's two kinds of support generally for those small module reactors. The Department of Energy has an advanced reactor demonstration program, which is funding a number of small module reactor designs to get them to the point of commercialization. And there was funding for that advanced reactor program in the IIJA. There are also new tax credits, specifically in the IRA, that are intended to make both existing and new nuclear generation more competitive. And so the federal government's sort of taking two approaches. One, it's funding the research and development on the front end to get small reactors, hopefully to the point of commercialization. And second, it's setting up a system of tax credits that provide compensation for the benefits that the federal government has decided that nuclear generation has, in particular its zero emission profile. So yes, there's support for both the development and the operation of those small modular reactors. The question ultimately will be timing. Many of those demonstration programs are still working. We are probably some number of years at least from the first commercialization of small modular reactors. And so the time frame at which that fits into your energy goals is to be determined. But I'll stop there. Kristen, if you have anything to add.
Erin, I think you covered the nuclear provisions both within IRA and IIJA really well. Like Erin said, the timeline for those demonstration projects is really going to be a couple years out in the future. So that funding for the demonstration projects is actually through FY 2028, if I believe. So it's a little bit longer than some of the other IIJA programs.
Any follow-up, Representative Anderson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Quick follow-up on that. Our state has a moratorium currently in place. Would that impact our two existing plants' ability to access some of these funds for existing nuclear plants?
Mr. Hildreth, or Ms. Hildreth, or Mr. Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Anderson. The short answer is I don't know. I'd have to look into more detail at your moratorium. My guess, and this is just a guess without looking at the language, is that it would not impact the ability to take advantage of some of the tax credits that are available for existing generation. It might implicate your ability to take advantage of funding that would support the development of new reactors, depending on your moratorium. I will say that a number of states that had moratoria on new nuclear development in recent years have modified or rescinded those moratoria with the intent of being able to take advantage of this new generation of reactors. But, you know, obviously you need to think about how that fits into your priorities. And I would need to look at the specific language to understand what the implications are for these particular programs. But we're happy to dig into that in more detail if that would be helpful.
Yep. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. One more question. I guess I'm putting my farmer hat on now. A lot of programs in these bills pertaining to building out the electric grid, and that's going to happen, that's coming. But just struck by pretty much a lack of comment or discussion on building out biofuels infrastructure. We're looking at it here in Minnesota, and increased blends of ethanol, biodiesel would provide immediate reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Anything in these bills that would help support the build out of infrastructure for biofuels in our state or nation?
I can add a little bit, and then Erin, if you'd like to chime on in as well. So the IIJA does include a significant amount of funding I think most of it's competitive for alternative fuels, and that alternative fuel section would include biofuels as well. The carbon reduction program looks at alternative fuel corridors as well. Biofuels are included in that. So there's a couple of different programs that touch on biofuels, but nothing that would or that are biofuel specific. They're research and investment in biofuels are included in a variety of programs. But there's not one program just specifically dedicated towards biofuel investment. Aaron, do you want to chime in at all?
I will add that in addition to the program that Kristen just mentioned, there was an existing tax credit on biodiesel and other alternative fuels. That tax credit had expired as of December 2021. The Inflation Reduction Act extended that tax credit through 2024. So there is a continued existing tax credit support for biodiesel in the IRA.
Thank you. All right, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question for Aaron. Do you, with the Clean School Bus Program, it looks like on page 11 here, it says $1.6 million is targeted for that. If you look at the cost of a brand new diesel bus, it's probably $220,000. So that would get you 7.5 buses. What does an electric school bus, like what would an electric bus cost? Is it around that $200,000 range? Or are we talking like we could maybe get one bus or two, a couple buses?
I don't have those numbers in front of me. We can follow up with you with more information about that. The intent of that program is to help districts be able to afford those buses, knowing that they are generally more expensive than diesel buses. One of the other considerations there is that you're reducing your long-term fuel costs. At least that's the intent. And so the challenge for districts is the capital cost up front. And so these programs are intended to support districts in doing that. But we can get you more information about sort of the comparative costs of the buses.
Yeah. I'll just add in there, so EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, did release earlier this year that the 2022 program was supposed to support around 2,500 school bus replacements overall. That gives you any idea of where they're thinking for the cost. Now, that said, for the 2022 cycle, the agency did receive around 2,000 applications requesting around $4 billion for over 12,000 buses. So it's really significant in terms of the number of districts, states, counties, et cetera, that are looking to access this funding for school buses.
Representative Gilman?
So just to follow up with that, so you're saying there was over 2,000 applications for it, and then so the funding piece is not $1.6 million for Minnesota, or... It's greater than that. That's
what it's that is what Minnesota will receive over the course of 5 years total. It's a $5 billion investment nationally. Just to look at that overall, though, those 2,000 applications requested $4 billion for FY 2022. So it's just going, to be a very highly competitive program across the board.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Kraft.
thank you, Madam Chair. Just one point on that prior thing. Boy, if we can figure out ways of having it so our kids don't have to breathe diesel fumes, I think it's worth looking into. My question for Mr. Ray, you were in talking about legislative prescriptions of things we could do. You talked about our energy plan and suggesting that it may be dated or needs some update. Can you give a little bit more background on what you meant by that?
Mr. Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft. I want to be very clear. I was not suggesting that the plan was dated or need updating. What I was suggesting is that you think about whether that plan is appropriate to guide these new investments. So I don't want to make a judgment about the sufficiency of your plan. I think the key is that there are a number of many investments in the energy system across these two bills, whether that's direct funding from the federal government, whether that's tax credits. Very few of those were considered in many states' energy plans. And so thinking about how does this changed ecosystem for the investment in the energy system change what you were thinking about as a state when you developed that plan. So I'll give you a couple examples. One of the things the IRA did is it extended or created new tax credits for renewable energy, both investment and production tax credits. That changes the economics for renewable energy developers. The question for state policy is, how will that implicate your particular energy policy goals? And does the state have an environment that will allow developers to make the best use of those tax credits to the extent that aligns with your energy policy goals? So, for example, do you have transmission in place to be able to bring new renewable generation onto your grid? If not, do you have a process to enable the development of that transmission? How are you going to consider some of the trade-offs around the development of new transmission or the siting of new infrastructure? All of these are big questions, but the certainty that the IRA provided for renewable developers means that there's going to be demand for that investment. And the question for states is, how do they engage with that new demand? So again, I'm not making judgment about the sufficiency of your plan, but I think it's important to revisit those plans given these new investments and think about whether there are opportunities to take advantage of some of these new things. Are there changes the state should consider? And how do all of these new investments align with your energy policy goals?
Good, thank you.
Representative Kraft, any follow-up? Representative Lead Franson.
Thank you. Just a little side note, Representative Kraft, regarding the diesel fuel with the children breathing in those fumes, it does come at a trade-off. There's children in third world countries that are mining the minerals for those batteries who will never have an opportunity to go into school. So might want to think about the children that are doing the mining for the batteries. Back to the electric school buses. Could somebody from NCSL give the committee an idea of exactly how much an EVB, an electric vehicle bus, actually costs if there were no subsidies?
Mr. Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Franson. I don't have those numbers in front of me. We can find that information for you, and we will share it with you after this testimony.
Representative Franson?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And so I did just a little quick Google here, and it looks like, according to one of our energy government sites, that a school bus averages around $400,000 per EV bus, which, according to the figures here for Minnesota funding, would be about approximately four buses without any subsidies. So something to just think about.
Thank you, Representative Franson. I know I kind of talked a lot about this with some of you guys, but when I think about this, I think about the Black Friday griddle I got that was $9, and you know I elbowed somebody to get it. And then I get home, and I'm just kidding. I get home and, you know, have burnt parts of my bacon, and other parts are raw. And then 2 months later, it breaks, and I have to go throw it away and go buy another griddle versus, like, the nice Cuisinart one that you pay a little bit more for, but, you know, has lasted pretty much the past 10 years, and it's going to last forever, I think, hopefully, knock on wood. So that's kind of one of the things that I think about with these, and I think with that school bus program, I think that's one of the big things is kind of making up that gap of the prices. So, you know, our school districts are planning for a $250,000 diesel bus. How can we come in and help bridge that, or how can the funding come in and bridge that gap and then help reduce costs in the long run when it comes to, you know, EVs have less moving parts and so they don't break down as often, you know, reduction in the fuel costs and things like that. And so just kind of taking that longer view, I think is something that would be really great. Representative Igo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is actually something I've been working on for a few years already, so I was really excited to see it talked about a lot. But it's all the work in carbon sequestration. So on page 20, it talks about the industrial tax credits. Couldn't agree with the statement more. A true all-of-the-above energy approach is needed. But with the 85% increase in carbon capture credit, combined with the $6 billion in competitive grants for carbon capture across this country, what can Minnesota be doing to be competitive? Because of all the research I've done, I'm very concerned we're going to lose out to states like Texas, Alabama, Alaska, who have very comprehensive energy committees and departments that run a lot of different things. So that's my question.
Ms. Hildreth or Mr. Ray?
I'm all happy to start. There are a couple of tools you might consider in terms of helping industry take advantage of those tax credits. One is states might consider matching tax credits. So you might decide that you want to match the federal tax credit with some state tax credit. Now there are implications there in terms of the trade-off of lost state revenue. But that's one opportunity you could pursue that states have pursued in some areas where there are federal tax credits available for some of these investments. A second thing to think about is how your state, again, sites infrastructure. The expectation for carbon sequestration across the country is that that resource, the carbon that is sequestered, will be transferred by pipeline. Many of those pipelines are in place, but you might need to move that resource, or operators might need to move that resource by pipeline. If the pipeline infrastructure doesn't exist, that's one place where you might either streamline permitting, consider corridors where pipelines could be developed. Those kinds of things would enable operators to take advantage of that resource. And then finally, there's lots of work that you all might already be thinking about where the resource will be captured, where the carbon will be captured, and where it will be sequestered. And many of the projects so far have tried to identify places where the capture is happening in close proximity to the basin where the carbon would be sequestered to minimize the transportation. One of the big questions, if this activity really develops at a commercial scale, is not all locations are suitable for sequestration. So you might be in a circumstance where that resource needs to be moved significant distances, and that has implications. So I would think about, are there state policies either to match or support industry and take advantage of some of those tax credits, and or state policies that can enable the infrastructure that will be necessary for operators to take advantage of those opportunities. So those are two areas to think about, but Kristen may have others that she wants to highlight.
Aaron, I think you covered all those really well. I think a lot of the actions states and states can take to make sure that they are competitive for so many of these programs really hinge on the two topics you just mentioned. So matching either tax credits for the IRA programs and or making sure your infrastructure can sustain.
Any follow-up, Representative Michael?
No, thank you. That was incredibly helpful. Just a closing comment. You know, Minnesota actually has the ability to do direct air capture, store on site without pipelines. It'd be something I'd love to talk to you about, Madam Chair, if you want to hear more about it. So thank you.
Well, I'm really, I don't see anybody else on the list. So last call for questions. Anybody? Okay. So I think, this was a really great, Ms. Hildred and Mr. Ray, thank you so much for zooming in. You didn't have to fly in and get this snowstorm, so technology wins here today. And I just really wanted to kind of reiterate my thoughts on this committee is, this is a policy committee, and so, we don't have a budget or anything, but how do we as a state set policies to meet our climate and infrastructure goals and support, I think that's the thing, is support our local entities that qualify for this funding with planning, project development, admin support, reporting support. And so I would actually request a little homework to our committee members. If you could maybe just touch base with some of your locals and see, what are some of the barriers to getting some of the infrastructure funding. What do our locals need? And also, what's working well? I'd like to know what's working well in Alexandria. I spend a lot of my time in Cass County, which I know you don't represent anymore, Representative Michael.
Yeah.
But, what I think about, the city of Longville. How the heck are they going to get federal funds? And so how do we make sure that we are working with our locals, with all of the entities that may qualify for some of this federal funding, and really supporting
the work of the folks on the ground. So I'm really looking forward to this committee. I really hope that we can work together to get some good policies, suggested to this, or get some good policies in place. And so anybody want to add anything? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment on your words about helping rural areas, smaller cities and towns get these federal funds. It was mentioned that a lot of these grants are going to be highly competitive. Mm-hmm. And one thing I hear is that our smaller towns and cities don't have the staff to maneuver the minutiae of applying for these grants. So anything we can help folks just work through the paperwork, bureaucracy of applying for the federal grants, I think would help these rural outstate areas, any smaller area unit of government.
Absolutely. Thank you. Lee Franson.
I was just going to piggyback off him. So.
Just a ditto.
But, I mean, and in a way, you kind of assume that, what I hear is that these smaller cities have never applied for federal grants before. Is that the case? Is that why you're saying, these smaller cities?
Well, I just, I think, one of the things is that we're at an unprecedented time where there's a lot of federal funding and, a lot of opportunity for one-time state funding as well. And so we just want to put, if I know, Minneapolis was able to get one of the Safe Streets grants, off the bat,
Right. It's Minneapolis.
Yeah, exactly. And so, Hennepin County has the capacity to build up and apply for the federal grants to respond to the moment in time that we're in. And so I just want to make sure that every county, every city, every township across the state of Minnesota has that same can respond the same way that any city in Minnesota can. And we know that infrastructure doesn't exist just in one city. It goes across the state. Minnesota, what Representative Hornstein has the most, third most miles of road in the country per cap?
In Hennepin?
No, just Minnesota has five most roads in the country. And so, our communities connect each other. We need to get stuff from Duluth down to Minneapolis. We need to get stuff from Red Wing out to War Road. And so that's really just kind of what I'm thinking of as far as making sure that we get the support to those locals.
So I would just maybe rephrase. It's not that our small cities don't know how to do the work. It's the staffing. Like, how can Longville or Osakis mm-hmm. or Melrose compete with a Minneapolis, right? So it's not that they don't know how, because they have been applying mm-hmm. for federal funds in the past. So let's not assume that they don't know how. It's just they need that staffing in order to be competitive.
Correct.
I suppose.
Yep. Yeah. And the thing too is, our locals know what they need, mm-hmm. and we need to hear from them and the community on what they need and what problems that we need to address in their physical infrastructure. And so, really, just getting, finding a way that the state can support that work. So I really look forward to this committee, and I really thank you all for being here. I think everybody was at least, 5 minutes late. That's pretty good. So with that, I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you.